You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an initiative in Milwaukee aims to make public spaces like Bradford Beach more accessible to people with disabilities. We'll learn more about the issue in just a bit. First, it's a big day in our state's history. 100 years ago today, Wisconsin became the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment, which gave many women the right to vote. A celebration took place earlier today at the state capitol. It featured some of the most prominent women in Wisconsin politics today, including former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish and State Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. More events are taking place around the state. Earlier this year, Governor Evers ordered the creation of a committee aimed at both honoring the women's suffrage movement and at finding new ways to educate citizens about Wisconsin's role in that process. We talked to Governor Tony Evers and First Lady Kathy Evers about the anniversary and their education efforts going forward. They joined us last week in advance of today's event. Governor Evers, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to be here to talk about important stuff.
And Mrs. Evers, welcome to the show.
Oh, I appreciate being here, too. Thank you.
Well, Mrs. Evers, what got you interested in remembering Wisconsin's role in ratifying the 19th Amendment?
Well, I'm the chair of the committee, and there's 70 great leaders and that are working to try to educate and engage the public in the celebration and the importance of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. So with these 70 strong women that are part of the committee, we're going to have some events all over the state, and we have a kickoff on June 10th.
And Governor Evers, I know there's a lot of partisan divisions in the country and in the state, but we have members of both parties on this committee, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is a bipartisan issue. It's a nonpartisan issue. Giving women the right to vote is an extremely important thing to recognize and to celebrate, even though, as an aside, at the time, that did not give all women the right to vote. Women of color were not part of that deal back then, but eventually we got it right. But yes, it's a good opportunity for the state to celebrate.
Mrs. Evers, can you talk about Wisconsin's role in the ratification of the 19th Amendment and how we ended up being first on the list?
We're going through having events to celebrate the 100th birthday, because we've got strong leaders throughout the state that are part of the committee and stuff like that, I think that's how we got involved with being the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. We're just very excited and proud of our state, and we want to continue to push for people's voting rights.
And Mrs. Evers, I know we've got this celebration marking the actual anniversary. What kind of education and things like that are you hoping to see in the year to come?
Well, we want to work with all levels of people, but we certainly want to do some educational packaging or tools that we're going to give to the schools to use. So we're hoping that will make a big difference. Just involving women overall into engaging and being part of something that's very important with the 19th Amendment and voting rights in the future. So the Wisconsin Historical Society is heavily involved with planning and preparing for this. And so they've just done a fantastic job getting events throughout the state. And we have our kickoff on June 10th, and it's going to be exciting and a fun time.
And Governor Evers, given your background in education here in the state, what are you hoping to see come out of this at the school level?
Well, we certainly want to have young people understand the importance of the date in that, and they understand that men and women did not have the equal opportunity to vote until the 19th Amendment was passed 100 years ago. And Wisconsin being the first state, you know, I think that will give young people the idea that we were on the cutting edge and historically important amendment, being the first state to do this, that our forefathers at that time was, I think, I'm sure the legislature were all men. At least they had the good sense to pass this immediately as soon as they could. and set the stage for the next 100 years, having women the right to vote. So I think it's an important history thing, but it's a historical issue. But I think it's important that they understand our place in history. We're number one. And second of all, that we also, as a result of that, we want girls and young women in our school system to think about how important it is to public service and being actively involved in the political process.
And Mrs. Evers, on the committee, have you talked a lot about women's leadership roles in Wisconsin today?
Yes, that's part of the whole process and events that we want to do. We have two leaders, women leaders, that are going to be speaking at the June 10th kickoff. We have the Honorable Rebecca Clayfish that's going to be with us, and the Honorable Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. So we're very excited to have them speak for us or speak to the public. The public's invited. It's a free event, and so we're hoping that we get lots of people to come out and take part in the events that are going to happen that day.
And Governor Evers, you mentioned that even though the 19th Amendment was ratified, it didn't mean all women were able to vote right away. Are there lessons about voting access that you're looking at as we mark this anniversary?
Oh, absolutely. Not only do I have to recognize that even at this important date that Wisconsin was historically number one in, it took years for everybody to have equal access to voting. And frankly, you know, as governor, I continue to be concerned about the fact that we seem to try to make voting more and more difficult. And that's just my opinion. But if we want a strong democracy, not only do we want to make sure that women have, you know, to recognize women's role in this and hopefully get young girls and young women interested in politics and in public service. But we also have to recognize that we have to continue to make voting as easy as possible for everybody in the state of Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there for now. Mrs. Evers, thanks for taking the time today.
Well, thank you very much, Rob.
And Governor Evers, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Have a good day.
Tony Evers is the governor of Wisconsin. Kathy Evers is the state's first lady. They joined us to talk about the 100th anniversary of Wisconsin's ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. Coming up, a local disability rights advocacy group is pushing to make public parks in Milwaukee more accessible. We'll learn more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll dig deep into the world of conspiracy theories and why people are drawn in by them with the author of the new book, Republic of Lies. First, for many people, heading to the park or a public beach can be a fun and relaxing way to spend an afternoon, but not everyone can easily visit those places. For some people with disabilities, heading to the park or spending time by the water can be out of reach if these areas haven't included special accommodations. Milwaukee-based nonprofit group is working to change that. Damian Bookman is the founder and executive director of the Ability Center. Damian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Before we dig into some specific projects you're working on, Damian, can you give us an overview of the kind of accessibility concerns you see in some Milwaukee area parks right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of what we talk about is not so much whether or not it's accessible, but is there an opportunity there? And I think that's a big difference that the public doesn't realize. Access means I can get in, but when we focus on opportunity, it's about how much can you access and what can you do.
So what kind of things do you work on to try to make it, again, not just minimal levels of accessibility, but maximum levels of opportunity?
Yeah, in the last couple of years, we have ramped up a few parks with the Milwaukee County Parks, who have been a great partner. We added ice skating sleds in Red Arrow Park. We added hand cycles in Veterans Park down at the lakefront so that everybody can bike the beautiful Milwaukee Lake. And then in 2015, when we first launched, we did this thing at Bradford Beach, and we promised that we would deliver a permanent ramp down there within 3 years. So we're a year behind, but that's what's coming up next.
Yeah, tell us about Bradford Beach. This is your big project, or a big project right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, again, we talk about that opportunity point. And right now, even if you had a ramp onto the beach, you would only still be able to get from A to B and maybe be 100 feet more on the beach. We're talking about not only being able to go from A to B on the sand, but also all the way to the water, and then including accessible beach wheelchairs that create independence that you can access the whole beach from A to Z.
And I saw pictures of this. There's a fixed ramp in place, and then I don't think I've ever seen this before, kind of a rollout ramp. Do I have that right?
Yeah, we will be building the fixed ramp this summer. But then, yes, there's also, it's called Moby Mat. It's this wonderfully amazing rollout of kind of a plastic meshed mat that goes over the sand that allows you to extend for a more economical option, an option that can also be rolled back up at the end of the day and rolled out every day so that the beach can be groomed. You know, and it's also not just good for people with disabilities, but also people, you know, moms and parents and families with strollers or people coming down to the beach with coolers. Generally, if access works for somebody with disability, it also works for the general public.
I've seen a lot of people paying more attention to that lately, and I'll say my personal experience. I remember once upon a time thinking, oh, these curb cuts are on the street are great for people who are using wheelchairs. Fast forward, I'm pushing a twin stroller around, and I'm all of a sudden a free rider on this too.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Safer to go down with your bike if you're on the sidewalks, which maybe you're not supposed to be, but it still works, right? Safer for our kids when they're riding their bikes. You know, it really works for everybody, and we kind of focus on that space that we should be creating universal access in all of our spaces. The Ability Center kind of focuses in that recreation, fitness, athletic space, and that's why we're teaming up with the parks and being good partners and good stewards in our community to make sure we can bring those opportunities at the same time, any day, anytime the public wants to use them.
I know another thing you've worked on is adaptive sports. We've talked about that some, I think even in the Milwaukee area on the show before. Can you talk about what kind of adaptive sports programs you're working on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the most recent thing we did was we actually launched a 3-on-3 wheelchair basketball league for anybody. So disability or not, there were actually 30 people who came and played, and only 3 actually had a disability or, you know, the need to use a chair while playing sports. And that showed that people want to play together. And that's what we talk about a lot is people want this opportunity to not be, you know, in small pockets of groups, but play with their friends of differing abilities.
Talking to Damian Bookman, founder and executive director of the Ability Center, about their work in the Milwaukee area to make sure public parks and recreational areas are not just accessible, but provide good opportunities for everybody to participate in activities there. Damian, can you talk about the kind of partnerships you work with to make some of these things happen?
Yeah, we've got great partners in the Metro Milwaukee YMCA, where we're also hosting our open gyms, again, giving an opportunity for people to play in what we say is just a different pair of shoes and experiencing adaptive sports together. We also do that with the Jewish Community Center. We do that as well with Wauwatosa Recreation. And we're also looking at all times for more partners in the community who want to bring that opportunity to their area.
And Damian, it seems like you're bringing a different philosophy than we see a lot of the time. As I kind of alluded to earlier, it seems like, okay, how do we meet these minimum standards under federal law?
Mm-hmm.
You're going for bringing people on board to go well beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, I was diagnosed with bone cancer when I was 13 and 14. And I can remember being 15 years old, looking outside of my window and seeing the neighborhood kids and my family in my driveway still playing basketball together. And I wasn't able to play with them anymore. And we knew, and I knew in our hearts, that people wanted to play together. And so we're saying, where are those opportunities for us to play as a family, as friends, as peers, as colleagues, and in my community, as opposed to always having to be a part of an adaptive sports team, which, of course, I also play wheelchair basketball, and I love my wheelchair basketball team and that high level of competition. But where's the recreation for just fun with my family, too? And so we found it to be just an unbelievable opportunity to bring that to the community and continually bring people into the spaces of open gym to introduce them to a whole new world together with their family.
I understand you're not thinking small here. You're looking at making Milwaukee a leader in these kind of opportunities.
Absolutely. I mean, you alluded to it earlier. We're thinking differently. We're not just thinking about the individual, but we're thinking about the collective family and the friends. We're not just saying this is for people with disabilities. Everything we're doing is we're saying this is for everybody, disability or not. We welcome everybody to play and participate with the Ability Center.
Have you seen other cities, other communities around the country with good ideas along these lines that you could steal or borrow, I guess?
I wish I could say that I've seen a lot of things that I could steal. I think we're kind of leading the way in the vision of not just thinking about the individual, but thinking about the collective. I think we're also, you know, I saw a local beach town, I think in the Carolinas recently, that put access into their beach. And I think that's fantastic. That's really great. But one of the things they missed when they placed a beach wheelchair is that it's not an independent chair. So if somebody has the independence and the capability to push their chair with the chair that this beach town chose, they wouldn't be able to do that. They would need somebody to push them. And we're thinking in our spaces and the equipment we place is that these are things that be used by an individual alone or also with the help of a caretaker. So we're leading the way a little bit in these spaces of making sure that if I'm alone, if I want to access it by myself and I have that capability, I can also do that.
If people are listening not in your part of the state, not in the Milwaukee area, thinking, yeah, why aren't we doing this in our town, in our community? How would you suggest they get started?
Well, I'll tell you, we have our Ramp Up program is something that we can go anywhere. So it starts up with Ramp Up MKE and different things in the Milwaukee and greater Milwaukee area. But we're also happy to go anywhere and show any community, any park district, any recreation department how to ramp up their community. So you would just really literally give Damien and the Ability Center a call, and we can come out and help you do that.
Have you done this for other communities in the state so far, or even, I guess, outside of the state?
I would tell you I recently had a call from San Antonio asking us how they might do that. We've had calls from companies in Colorado or organizations in Colorado, I should say, trying to understand how they can better make their facilities more accessible as well. And so, again, we're kind of leading the way in that space, and people are starting and beginning to ask us, what did you do and how did you do it?
As you do these programs and projects around the Milwaukee area, are you getting converts, people who maybe play those adaptive sports, whether they're people with disabilities or not, saying, this is awesome, how do we make it go further?
100%. I mean, we have continually people coming back, able-bodied or volunteers, disabled, et cetera, coming to our open gyms, right? I mentioned that 3-on-3 wheelchair basketball league, only 10% of the people who played even had a disability, and all of those people are asking us, when is the next league? And we're hoping to expand that in the fall and spring as opposed to just a winter league.
We talked earlier, your goal is to make Milwaukee a leader here, and you're already doing that some. Do you see this as an opportunity for potential tourism, for people with families saying, hey, yeah, we've got this opportunity, all of us can participate in this recreation?
I think without a doubt. I mean, to know that I can go into a community and find accessibility and opportunity, and that that's going to be kind of the basis of idealism inside of said community, it would absolutely attract someone there. My team, when we travel for wheelchair basketball, we go to restaurants that we know are generally accessible. So we find that chain restaurant that we know we will be able to be accommodated at, and we choose that. And so to be able to put that in our community and people around the country to know that Milwaukee has taken that on, I absolutely believe it will attract tourism.
Now, we've talked mostly about public spaces. Do you see this as your work in Milwaukee potentially influencing private business owners to start thinking along similar lines?
I would sure hope so. I think the more that these opportunities put people with disabilities in the community because they've been provided that opportunity of not just ADA guideline accessibility, I think we're going to see more of it, we're going to understand more of it, and we're going to appreciate why it's important. When you put a significant ramp down at a major landmark like Bradford Beach and people see that and see people using it, they start to understand more why it's important when they can see it in front of their face every day. So the more that we can, you know, create those experiences, which is another reason why we want people to play together, is to have that experience together and realize, oh, people can, they are able if provided the opportunity.
You're working on a local level there in Milwaukee. Do you see opportunities for the state, maybe the state government, state departments to get involved and help promote this around Wisconsin?
I don't know why not, right? I mean, the most significant problem for people with disabilities are secondary conditions like heart disease, diabetes, obesity. These things are preventable. These things are often covered, you know, via the healthcare system through Medicaid and Medicare, and therefore government-based tax dollars. So the healthier we can make this population who has the most significant need, it really benefits everybody. And we also have this thing where we talk about, you know, we all in across the entire country, the world, we belong to one demographic, and that's what we call TABS, which stands for temporarily able-bodied. So the thing is whether it is disease or whether it's an accident or whether it's old age, we are all going to have a need for greater access in the community. And like I said earlier, I learned that when I was diagnosed with bone cancer at 13 years old.
Let's take things back to Bradford Beach now. You mentioned it had a timeline. It got extended a little bit. So what now is the timeline? When are you hoping to have the full fixed ramp and rollout ramps ready to rock?
Well, so we launched a GoFundMe campaign last week along with Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley, who contributed $25,000, and the Parks Director and the County Parks, who contributed $10,000. We have a goal of $100,000 in order to build that ramp, and we hope that we're going to achieve that ramp in the next month so that people still get the summer to participate, to access the beach, to play down at the lakefront.
We'll leave it there for now. Damian, thanks so much for joining us today and telling us about the project.
Thanks so much for having us on, spreading the news.
We've been talking to Damian Bookman, founder and executive director of the Ability Center. He joined us today to talk about efforts to make Milwaukee's parks and public beaches more accessible and provide more recreation opportunities to people with disabilities. A reminder, tomorrow on Central Time, we're going to talk about music and how we collect it. We hear that Apple is ending their big iTunes program. Everybody had mixed feelings about it over the years, I think, but that has a lot of people worried about the future of their digital music collections. We want to hear from you, digital, analog, whatever. How do you collect music? What form does your music collection take? Call our call-in line. Tell us if it's tapes, vinyl, CDs, LPs, digital, streaming. What do you do? Call 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-3327. Share your story there, and we can share it with everyone tomorrow. Let us know how you collect music. Coming up, we'll take a dive into the world of conspiracy theories. The author of the new book, Republic of Lies, joins the show. Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. We'll take a look at the conspiracy theory past and present and why our guest says this is a big time for him. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at DNR investigations of a controversial pollutant at a major Wisconsin manufacturer. Get the details tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. But now...
So finally, we're all in agreement about what's going on with the adults. Millhouse. Okay, here's what we've got. The RAND Corporation, in conjunction with the Saucer People.
Thank you.
Under the supervision of the reverse vampires, are forcing our parents to go to bed early in a fiendish plot to eliminate the meal of dinner. We're through the looking glass here, people.
A conspiracy theory there from Bart Simpson and Milhouse Van Houten. Conspiracy theories have long been a part of the American psyche, with concerns going back at least as far as the Revolutionary War. But our next guest writes that there's a surge of this type of thinking today, which she says often happens at times of change and social upheaval. Anna Merlin is a journalist at GEO's investigative division, the Special Projects Desk. Her new book is called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start on a cruise. This is where you first really started to explore this issue of conspiracy theories, a sea cruise. Tell us about that.
So in January of 2016, I went on a week-long cruise for conspiracy theorists called the Conspiracy, that went to Mexico and back. And on the cruise, I noticed that a lot of people from different conspiracy communities were really excited about Donald Trump and really saw him as a truth teller in a style that they enjoyed and were excited about the prospect of his, you know, potential presidency. And I wondered what was going to happen to those folks and other people that Trump was sort of revitalizing when he lost the election. And then he didn't. So really my impetus for writing this book was trying to understand, you know, how conspiracy communities were influencing the United States and really trying to come to terms with things about the U.S. that I don't think that I fully understood.
Let's talk about what a conspiracy theory is, if you have a working definition. And of course, nobody wants to be told that they are participating in a conspiracy theory.
Right. So a conspiracy theory is the idea that a hidden, powerful group of people are working in secret to effect some negative change or do something that impacts the common good in a negative way. And a conspiracy is when a group of people are working in secret against the common good.
And you write that a problem in some cases in debunking or challenging conspiracy theories is there are real world examples of people working together to do harm to others.
Right. Especially in the United States, there are so many examples, particularly of the government doing things in secret that are, you know, outrageous and have really damaged the public trust for years and decades.
We're talking to Anna Merlin. Her new book is Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, why would this last couple of years be a ripe ground for conspiracy theories?
Right. Well, you know, we know from a lot of studies, particularly in the United States, that conspiracy theories tend to well up again during times of social change, social upheaval, when we're really questioning who we are and our values. And that has certainly been true since the election of Donald Trump. And even before that, you know, we saw a rise in conspiracy theories during the Obama presidency, especially on the far right and among militia groups, you know, concerns about the Obama administration taking away people's guns, things of that nature. So the more polarized we get politically, the more conspiracy theories we're going to see.
And this isn't a new thing in some ways. You point in your book toward big surges in conspiracy theories over American history. Can you point toward a couple of those?
I mean, we can talk about something like the Salem witch trials is a really good example. You know, it was, you know, literally a belief that there was a group of people working in secret to serve a powerful adversary, in that case, Satan. You know, also, there have been sort of any number of hysterias, especially about perceived outside groups. We know that before World War I, for instance, most of the conspiracy theories in the United States were about groups like Jews, Catholics, Freemasons, Mormons, people who were believed to be plotting to seize control or infiltrate the government. And then after World War I, as the government grew larger, most of the conspiracy theories began to be about the government itself and who was really in charge of it.
There's one new element, though, that wasn't there for all of those, the internet and now social media. How do you see that fitting into the conspiracy theory landscape?
Yeah, I see social media as much more of an impact than the internet at large. Social media allows conspiracy communities to find each other, to fuse together, and it allows more and more people to see conspiratorial ideas who might not have been exposed to them before. And the effect that that has is sort of still being studied. But anecdotally, we definitely know that conspiracy communities get a lot more eyes on them. And some conspiracy theories like QAnon, a sort of bizarre pro-Trump conspiracy theory, are entirely creations of social media.
You've used the word a community talking about conspiracy theories. And in the book, you talk about spending a lot of time with people who get together to have events related to their whatever their conspiracy theory is. Do you see that as part of the appeal, that it's bringing together a group of people who think they have it right and everybody else who has it wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people that I talk to, whatever their particular idea is, it has brought them purpose, meaning, a perceived community, even if it's not one in real life and it's only one that exists on social media. But most importantly, I think it gives people a way to feel like they are participating, especially people who have previously felt really locked out of systems of power, have felt like they don't have a way to impact public officials, the government, public opinion. They really feel that they are participating. And a lot of times this participation is extremely negative when it comes to communities, for instance, who believe, you know, that every mass shooting is faked with the help of crisis actors or communities of people making anti-vaccination claims. But there is no question that it is a community nonetheless.
And it's a community with celebrities in some cases you look at, and you had a very brief chat, I believe, with Alex Jones.
I did, yes. I met Alex Jones at the RNC, the Republican National Convention, when that was happening before the presidential elections. And I wrote about the fact that, you know, I had this brief kind of bizarre conversation with Alex Jones that I wasn't inclined to take very seriously. Meanwhile, as it turned out, he was there meeting with Roger Stone, who was then an advisor to Donald Trump. You know, Alex Jones was there on serious business that I simply didn't take into account.
We're talking to Anna Merlin, author of the book Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a rise in conspiracy theories and conspiratorial thinking? Do you see it in person, on the internet, in your social media feed? What does it mean for our culture and our politics? What do you think drives it? If you're something who doesn't think something is a theory at all, how does being called a conspiracy theorist affect you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our exploration of modern conspiracy theories and the effects they have on our politics and our culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the appeal of conspiracy theories? What leads them to thrive? Is it social change, fear of people who are different? What do you think conspiracy theories tell us about ourselves, about humanity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anna Merlin is with us. Her new book is called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, at some points in my life, I think conspiracy theories looked maybe kind of quaint. You know, some odd loners would get into them. It seems like more and more these days they actually have a real and often negative, as you said, effects on the real world. What happened?
I think there is a perception that conspiracy theories used to be harmless and now they're not, which is not necessarily accurate. You know, as we've discussed, they've bubbled up at various times in American history and have had an ill effect. I think the other thing that has been sort of poorly understood is that a lot of conspiracy theories are a sort of direct response to social inequality. You know, there's a lot of research to show that conspiracy theories are slightly more common among people of color, for instance, and there are conspiracy theories that are really specific to Black Americans because those conspiracy theories are based in actual outrages that have been committed against the Black community in the United States for years. You know, so the idea that conspiracy theories used to just be Bigfoot and now there's something more serious is not really correct, but it's understandable why people feel that way.
And conspiracy theories around the world, speaking of harmful ones, you talk about the forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The conspiracy mm-hmm. theories often seem to find their way back to anti-Semitism in particular. Do you see that a lot in meeting with people who are conspiracy theory practitioners today?
I would say that a lot of more harmful conspiracy theories are fundamentally rooted in some kind of xenophobia or some kind of paranoia about an outside influence or enemy. And a lot of times, yeah, that does tend to come back to anti-Semitism, I think, because anti-Semitism is one of the oldest sort of forms of paranoia about an outside group supposedly taking over or taking effect. I do have people talk to me about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was proved to be a forgery, you know, over 100 years ago. I do have a lot of people talking to me, whether they realize it or not, about ideas that fundamentally echo the blood libel, which is a medieval idea that Jews were kidnapping Christian children and murdering them in occult rituals. Things like Pizzagate, which is a much more modern conspiracy theory, really do kind of echo those ideas.
Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for having this guest because this is right up my fairway. I actually have a YouTube channel with 120,000 subscribers, and we talk about conspiracies. And the question I have is, I've looked at a lot of different parts of what we call, which is a bad term, the conspiratorium, and some things are true and some things aren't. Does the writer of the book actually acknowledge that some of the conspiracies are true?
Yeah, we talked about that quite a bit. I mean, the whole point of the book really is the idea that the public trust has been extremely damaged by actual conspiracies that took place and were perpetrated by the U.S. government. You know, when the Church Committee in the 1970s exposed some of what the FBI had been doing, for instance, by infiltrating activist groups and civil rights communities, you know, that in itself created such a framework for people to distrust the government forever and created so many, you know, possibilities for people to believe in certain kinds of conspiracy theories. So, yeah, you know, I mean, the history of this country creates a fertile ground for conspiracy thinking.
Steve, thanks for the call. Go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So my comment is, again, that there's a lot of, you know, things that were thought of as conspiracy theories at the time, which sounded outlandish, such as, you know, UFOs. But then it turned out that some of these things people were actually seeing was just advanced technology that the U.S. military had created, such as, you know, the B-2 stealth bomber or the SR-71 Blackbird. And then there's also stuff like the group MC Ultra, where they talk about, you know, that they tried to do mind control. Well, they did experiment with LSD on people with the Tuskegee experiment to see, you know, as well as other ones at UCLA Berkeley, to see how people's minds would relate and, you know, and what they could actually do to manipulate a mind.
Marcus, thanks for the call. A couple different things there. MK Ultra was the LSD one that did happen. The Tuskegee experiment was a horrific syphilis experiment. But again,
yeah,
pointing
actually
towards bad things. Yeah.
Yeah, we're kind of conflating a few different things. MK Ultra was a CIA mind control program. It was the CIA trying to determine if they could actually create a mind control program and use it for military purposes. The other thing is the Tuskegee experiments, which was a group of black men with syphilis were purposely allowed to continue having the disease in order to test the progression of the disease long after the government knew what the cure was. So again, there's all these examples in U.S. history of real conspiracies that have led people to believe that just about anything is possible. Another one that he did not mention, but I think was being referred to, was the idea that the government was secretly dosing people with LSD, which is true.
Thanks for the call. In our last few minutes, Anna, let's talk about what we do about this and how we know, given that, yes, some bad things have happened, how do we know from the midst of an outlandish conspiracy theory that isn't true?
Right. I mean, I think the fundamental argument of the book is that the more that we create a just and transparent society, the less need there will be for conspiracy theories, because there will be less for people to conspiracy theorize about. For instance, we're seeing a lot of paranoia right now and a lot of conspiracy theories about rigged voting machines, the idea that, you know, President Trump isn't going to step down when his term in office is over, which is actually a conspiracy theory that also came up about President Obama at the end of his term. So the idea, if we have a more directly representative democracy, that there will be fewer conspiracy theories, for instance, about rigged voting, I think is very persuasive and very effective. And so we see that throughout American society. There are so many conspiracy theories about the medical establishment, about, you know, the IRS and taxes. All of these systems are in really fundamental need of reform in order to produce fewer conspiracy theories about them, which is a frustrating answer and one that will take us a really long time, but is, in my view, the best way to address these things.
Is it easier to just believe in a really out there conspiracy theory about something that is genuinely bad than it is to take action to try to fix the real problems?
I don't know if it's easier necessarily, but I think those things have a really strong emotional appeal for a lot of people. And again, as we've talked about, can make, you know, some logical sense. And, you know, it's worth stressing too that not every conspiracy community is sort of equally harmful. I write in the book about going to a UFO conference, and while some corners of the UFO world, you know, are delving into some genuinely weird and not so positive stuff, the general idea that maybe we're not alone in the universe and having a curiosity about other forms of life elsewhere in the galaxy, you know, is a pretty, in a way, beneficial thing.
We'll leave it there for now. Anna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Anna Merlin, journalist at Geo Media in New York. Her new book is called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Climate change is transforming our world in many ways, from extreme weather events to rising seas to more frequent wildfires. A Wisconsin researcher who studies lakes is drawing attention to another one. Mercury is now moving in unexpected ways. That has some big implications for human health. WPR's Sarah Weitz-Kotacek has more.
Jeff Rubsum works for UW-Madison and the Department of Natural Resources. In mid-March, he drilled into ice on a northern Wisconsin lake to take water samples.
The ice is frozen on top, and then there's kind of a slush layer in there, and then you start into hard ice again.
Rubsum's boss is Carl Watrous. Watrous has studied mercury levels for 32 years. He discovered when water levels go up, mercury in fish does too. And then the opposite occurs. When water levels go down, mercury levels go down.
It's like a roller coaster going downhill, and that's because climate has kicked in, and we've seen dramatic changes in water levels over the past 30 years or so.
Mercury is a neurotoxin that harms the brain, especially in kids. Coal-fired plants are the biggest emitter of mercury into the atmosphere. About two-thirds of mercury in the environment is from past emissions. And it doesn't leave once it's there, says MIT atmospheric chemist Noelle Saline.
So this is why climate ends up being really important, because of this important impact of the legacy mercury that continues to affect us. And the flip side of that is also that the mercury that we're emitting today turns into tomorrow's legacy mercury.
The mercury in the atmosphere gets into fish when it rains down into plants and trees that decompose in water. So when water levels go up, plants on the lake's edge are submerged and start to die. And when there are higher levels of water, more trees decompose and release more mercury into the lake. The DNR's Carl Watrous points to some dying trees at Little Rock Lake in northern Wisconsin.
Can you see those two pines that are right there? Their needles are sort of yellowish rather than deep green. They are probably on their way out.
Wisconsin began to regulate mercury in 2004. Since then, concentrations in lakes have gone down. But the Trump administration wants to roll back plans to reduce mercury into the environment. Some advocates worry Wisconsin's DNR may do the same. Julie Enslow is an environmental activist for the grassroots organization Milwaukee 350. She spoke at a Sierra Club news conference in Milwaukee in April. She's against a proposal by the utility company We Energies to increase the amount of mercury it can discharge at its Oak Creek power plant near Milwaukee each day.
We Energies should be here today, and they should be standing here apologizing for the polluting of Lake Michigan, not asking to increase that pollution.
We Energy spokesman Brendan Conway says while the utility is asking for more flexibility in the amount of mercury it discharges day to day, its overall goal is to emit less.
We live in this community as well, right? We know how important it is. We care deeply about the environmental sustainability and about public safety and about public health.
Carl Watrous with the DNR says even with future emission reductions, it will be hard to see progress. With water levels fluctuating from climate change, even lower mercury emissions may not always lead to cleaner fish. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, WPR News.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a number of corporations are taking public political stances, sometimes even on divisive issues. We'll look at the changing face of corporate activism, whether it makes a difference, and whether it costs companies money when they do it. A lot of us have a complicated relationship with all the things we buy and own. Psychologist Regan Gurung joins us for a look at stuff and what it says about us, and you can join the conversation with your own story as well. And Apple is killing iTunes, but it looks like everybody gets to keep their music files. We'll look at the ever-changing ways we listen to music, from albums to CDs to downloads to nowadays streaming. Almost said screaming. And you can share your story. Do you keep a bunch of vinyl around still? Do you buy new vinyl albums? Do you have a big CD collection? Have you gotten rid of it and gone completely digital? If so, how, and have you liked it? Call in now. Share your story at 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-3327, and leave us a message. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.